A Shishkin Productions podcast.
Come join us tomorrow on Tuesday, May 9th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 120 Jewell Street in Brooklyn,
right,
at the Broadway stages.
We'll be there.
We'll be picketing.
Meet some writers, maybe pick up some work.
Yeah, why not?
Hey, what's up, Sizzlers? Welcome to another episode of the Sizzle Reel Podcast.
We're still here.
We're here in the Matt H. King Memorial Podcast Arena.
Yep. No launch today.
This shit is fucking blowing up, bruh. Everyone's here watching us in the arena.
Yeah.
We have t-shirt cannons.
We have a stadium audience.
Yeah, we got that lady who rides the unicycle shooting arrows out of her
red panda
feet. Maybe I'm combining two.
Yeah, I think I'm combining two.
I'm conflating two NBA League Pass halftime acts.
Yeah, having all these people just like right outside looking through the podcast studio windows.
On the outside looking in a lot.
It makes me feel almost like a zoo animal.
Dude, that's my life. I do feel like a zoo
animal. I'm a little edit monkey.
If someone feels like a zoo animal, is that just like heavy narcissism or like egotism? It's like, I feel like everyone's watching me. No one cares about you. No one cares about you, zoo animal.
Yeah, okay? I don't know. Do you think zoo animals are narcissistic? Do you think it gets to their head that they're like...
Yes,
you know, these
totally. They're like gods. They're on a pedestal. Despite all my rage, I am an edit rat in a cage.
Hell yeah.
What's up, Chris?
not too much. It's been an interesting week, you know, just the standard MLS stuff so far. Still fighting with
do social plug. I mean, when I say what's up, it's just hello. I got to rename the segments from what you've been up to something else, because
okay.
Plug the socials first.
All right.
I've been doing this for 3 years.
Yeah, whatever. We've been doing it for 3 years. They should know where to find us.
That's a great point.
We are...
Push the blame to the listener. I'm taking notes.
Come on, Sizzlers. Get it together.
The recipe for a successful podcast. One, do it. Two, don't promote it. Three, blame the listener.
I think we're doing good so far.
We are
at SizzleRealGang on Twitter and Instagram. We are SizzleRealGang@gmail.com. And of course, we have Sizzle Reel Gang, the website.com.
Yes, I almost forgot about that.
You thought I was going for the hotline,
yeah,
didn't you?
You saw me react. I was like, wait, what? Like, what do we? We do. We do have a website.
It's new and improved.
New and improved.
I don't know how long we can keep saying that, but
forever. I'll keep improving it.
It exists.
God damn it. I'll make a pact right now to the Sizzlers.
Okay.
I will improve this website every chance I get. All right.
Yes. We're going to pay $10 a month for the rest of our lives just to keep meme going.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not $10 a month, because this one, I don't pay the Wix price.
Oh.
That's why, like, it just redirects to. So I pay GoDaddy, like, you know, $10 a year.
Okay.
But which is fine. I'm down to do $10 a year for the bit. Who cares?
Yeah, why not?
I got this pen in my hand. I'm just pointing everywhere. It's like a lot.
Me out.
Well, it feels powerful. I mean, try it here.
Okay.
Here, take this pen.
All right.
And then when you talk, you see?
Okay. I like this. I feel like I'm a teacher or something
right now.
And of course, we have the Sizzle Reel Cold Line. That is
332-333-4361.
I feel like a conductor.
It's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Okay, enough of this fucking bullshit. Let's get serious.
Okay.
The second half of the show is going to be serious.
Yes.
Because right now, our brothers in arms in these fucking edit and video battlefields are on strike.
They are.
The Writers Guild, WGA. Yes. Am I union? No.
No.
I've never been anything close to it, but I still support these motherfuckers.
Well, yeah, and I think even non-union editors, like, they still use union rates as a starting point.
As a guide.
Yeah, which,
the union works for all of us.
It really does. You don't have to be in the union to support it or to be a part of
the whole movement.
The movement,
the whole idea.
Yes.
So the second half of the show is going to be dedicated to this WGA thing, maybe trying to get you guys a little bit more caught up on what's going on.
Yeah, I got to get caught up first.
Yeah, well, that's why we're recording the first half first. But before, I mean, the first half, we'll keep it a little bit lighthearted. What have you been up to, Chris?
The standard MLS stuff, and I've been fighting with this Amazon S3 Snowball Edge, whatever.
Yeah, that thing is a mess.
Dude, I unfortunately don't think it's going to work out. So what keeps happening is I'm starting with like a 6 terabyte transfer, and it starts out really nice. Speeds are great for like the first day or so, and it says it's going to take, you know, maybe a day and a half to upload. And it's going at like 200 megabits per second, and then it kind of slowly goes down to like 150, then 100, then 80, and it kind of sticks around there. But what's actually happening when I look at it, it says that it's still at 80, but nothing is being uploaded. This is the second time it's happened now. It gets X percentage into the transfer, and then it just kind of stops working, even though it says it still is. So my...
I wonder if you zip the whole thing, if that would make it go, actually go.
It might.
But still, that adds a whole different...
It does. That would take forever.
Time on the front end. Yeah.
Yeah. And...
And it probably will fail.
And then
the zip will be corrupt when we try to open it, and it won't even work.
Yeah, and then when we try to download it back, you know, it's like I wouldn't be able to get the individual folders.
Oh, that's a good
if
point.
I want one project and all of the
Right. Totally right.
So the last couple things I'm gonna try, I'm gonna swap out a couple of the Ethernet cables and see if it's just a faulty cable. I'm going to try using, so right now the Snowball is connected through a 10 gigabit adapter going into a USB-C port. I'm going to swap that and
go directly into the port,
go directly into the computer, because right now our actual server is plugged up to my computer that way, but I don't really need to be on the server today, so I'm going to try that out.
Yeah, give it a go today and see what it does. But I'm with you. I think that it's probably, it might just not be the solution.
Yeah,
unfortunately, because at this point too, like, you know, April was pretty chill, so we had time to work on it.
Yeah,
and it has been taken up, like, it took way longer than anticipated, and now May and June are about to get busy, so I feel like it's gonna be,
I'm also gonna try doing like one small folder at a time, like each project folder individually instead of the entire drive.
Right.
But that's gonna require a lot of babysitting. I'm really just gonna do that as a proof of concept, because I don't think we have time to keep running around doing this. I think we
I agree,
gotta bite the bullet and get a NAS, and we'll figure out an off-premises solution.
I'm gonna start calling it a NAS.
A NAS,
little
NAS.
Made you look.
Ooh.
All I need is one drive.
Okay.
Like, these are NAS references. These are over your head.
No. I missed the 90s.
He kept making things into the 2000s.
Were they relevant?
What else have you been? Yes, they were relevant. Actually, what else have you been doing?
What else have I been doing?
Nothing.
That's basically
soccer shit.
Soccer shit. Yeah, I've been helping produce Calling All Casuals where I can. And Calling All Casuals, I don't know if it's been announced yet, but there might be a new producer coming in.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there is. There is a new producer. Actually, you know, that episode posted on Friday.
Okay.
Yeah. So of this record, it posted 7 minutes ago.
That's very exciting.
Pretty cool stuff. Speaking of casuals, we formed a office trivia team.
We did.
We were like, you know what? Our team building activities went out the window with our new structure. So we have to take little small victories where
we
can get them.
We got
to
do free things.
So we did bar trivia and we won.
Our
first ever time we played, first place, dude. We're the ultra casuals. We won a $50 bar tab.
Yeah, that's
very cool.
First time I've ever won trivia. I've only played maybe like a dozen times or so, but it's the first time I've ever won trivia, and it was in dramatic fashion. It was on a last minute tiebreaker. There are three teams tied for first.
Yep.
And then we had to guess how many licensed cheese manufacturers there were in Wisconsin.
And we weren't even allowed to phone Coop,
which was crazy because he's
from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Yeah, the boss from La Crosse. And Alexi went with 666.
I just said, you know what? We're not going to actually guess this, so let's just put a number.
That's an impossible, like, no one could know that.
So we put 666.
Yeah, and we were the closest. It was not Price is Right rules. It was just whoever was closest. But we also did not go over.
We would have won either way.
The real answer was like 1,000 something.
Something,
I don't know.
Who knows? We had a little meeting in Long Island City with our friends over at a magazine called Slam.
Yes.
Like a basketball magazine. And while we were over there, we decided to look at some real estate, and we were like, you know what? Let's see. Maybe if we need to move next year or something, or in the next 6 months, we can find a spot.
Yeah.
It looked really cool. I was a big fan of it, but I think that there's just a few things that need to fall into place for it to happen.
Sure.
It just was a little too expensive.
It's a little too expensive. And here's the thing. It's like we're not... really like looking to move immediately. This is more doing our due diligence and making sure, because eventually we are going to have to upgrade our space, especially, you know, we've got some potential contracts down the line that we think we might be able to get, and they would require several people being in here probably every day of the week. And well, right now our space can accommodate maybe five or six comfortably, but we,
and if we need more, then we're really fucked.
Yeah. And well,
not even, it's like five or six. That's max capacity, probably. You're six is probably max capacity.
Yeah, but you know, it starts to get a little bit cramped.
Five is max capacity in terms of editors, I guess, who can be on the... Well, we have extra spots in servers, so we could plug laptops up. Whatever, it's a whole fucking thing.
Yeah, I mean, we're just not...
Point is,
totally
it would be nice to have more.
You know what I mean? And you know, if we do get these contracts, that money would allow us to expand a little bit.
Right.
So it's all kind of contingent on that.
Well...
But it, you know, it's nice to know what's out there so that we're not, you know, starting from scratch whenever we do need to move.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I guess, should I let the Sizzlers know or do you want to let, I'll let them know. So part of the reason we also want to potentially move is because Sizzle Reel is in talks to get acquired. We basically just have to sign the papers, cross the T's, dot the I's. But I'm happy to announce BlackRock will be purchasing Sizzle Reel.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So they have a ton of open real estate, so I think we'll be fine. But BlackRock is purchasing Sizzle Reel. So that is going to be, I think, around... We were going to like wait till episode 150 to have the big bonanza. And I think we still will. But I'm really excited for that. So check out the website for updates on that. BlackRock purchasing Sizzle Reel.
Yes. Yeah. They're going to really inject us with some money.
Yeah, dude. We got the Sound Shark, which I'm going to test out this weekend.
Yes.
We have potential to maybe that we might go film a soccer thing, which would require us to capture audio of a subject that's about probably 30 to 50 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have, like, we're trying to figure out the best path to capture that audio from them, because we're not going to be able to put a microphone on them. We just have to like figure out the best way to capture it. Sound Shark is like a little parabolic mic that goes on top of your camera. It's like a little dish. So it's like a little plastic parabolic dish. Think about like in football games where you look on the sidelines, you see those guys holding these giant parabolic plastic dishes.
This is like a handheld version of that.
Right. This is a tiny little one, and it goes on top of your camera. And so whatever you're pointing your camera at, theoretically, this picks up the audio from that thing.
Sure.
It can work. It says up to 50 feet.
Yeah. So basically you put a little lav mic in this dish facing towards the dish.
Yeah.
And you know, it picks up all the sound waves coming into there and kind of centers it on that focal point.
That is the craziest thing to me that I learned about parabolic mics when I was trying to get this is that when you see those guys on the sidelines with those giant dishes, you just in your head, or maybe I falsely imagined that it's a giant dish, and I thought there's like a shotgun mic inside of it.
I
or
thought
something
there was a
like
shotgun
that,
mic, 100%.
Pointing at what it was.
Yeah.
No, it's the mic actually is a, like you said, a lavalier mic, and it's pointed backwards inside towards the dish.
Yeah.
The dish is what does all the work. The sound collects that way. You know, so it's very interesting. I guess maybe a lot of people knew that. I didn't know that.
No, I was not aware, but it's cool, and I'm excited to work with it. Now, we did do one project back kind of COVID era where they had parabolic dishes. We didn't capture it. We just edited it. But they had parabolic dishes on the pitch for an MLS game.
Yes.
And it worked really well because it was COVID and there were no fans in the stands.
Right.
So I'm curious to see how well this picks up with those extra fans. Because like, I know, you know, it works really well with the NFL from what I can see. Mm-hmm. However, in those NFL stadiums, the fans are raised up a little bit off of the field.
True.
And most soccer pitches, the fans are kind of right there. They're level with it. Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see kind of what we get. I know that we're going to try a couple different things. It's kind of going to be more of a test that we're doing.
Yeah.
So we're trying a couple different audio capture things. So I'm actually really excited for that.
Yeah.
I might go to Philly for it. So
it's going to be fun.
Other things that I guess we could talk about is the dock, the Treefort dock.
Yeah.
So it's going to be showing friends and family screening May 20th. At a place called Stewart Cinema in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. if you are a Sizzler, you probably are friends and family.
Yeah, so, I was about to say, Sizzlers are invited.
Yeah, Sizzlers are friends and family. They're invited.
But you have to let us know if you're interested in attending. You have to RSVP.
Yeah, you need to email us, sizzlerealgang@gmail.com. Just email us and say, hey, I'm interested in coming to the screening, and we'll put your name on the list, or we'll send you the link to RSVP, whatever.
Yep.
But it's limited capacity. So if you want to go, please
be quick about it. There's maybe 10 to 15 spots left.
There's 10 seats left.
Okay.
And you'll have it. You know what we're going to do? We're going to reserve seats for the Sizzlers right front row. The front row right up in front of the screen.
Yeah, front row isn't best as seats, nice at the theater.
Best seats in the house for the Sizzlers.
It's going to be great. There's going to be food and beverage for purchase. The screening itself is free, right?
Free. Yeah. And then afterwards, we're going to go get some beers probably at some brewery right around there.
Yeah.
The movie is about how much of a struggle it is being a musician, a touring musician, an independent musician, and also kind of how... the middle class is getting squeezed out of music. I mean, I'm like a broken record. The middle class gets squeezed out of literally everything. Well, that's the whole second half of the show.
The middle class
basically
is getting squeezed out from existence.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and so, I don't know. We talk about it a lot. We talk about kind of, you know, what are the steps to a more equitable future for artists, for musicians, and kind of goes in very nicely to this first little news story. Live Nation announced that they posted $3.1 billion in revenue, record attendance. So
that's just for Q1.
That's for Q1 of 2023. $3.1 billion in revenue. That's a record. And it's up 73% from the same period last year. Now, that's a weird one because we were still trying to come back to concerts. So that's, but still a record, $3.1 billion in one quarter.
It's pretty frustrating. I mean, cause they more or less have a monopoly on like live concerts. Yeah. You know, there's a couple artists who are fighting back between, you know, whether it be Taylor Swift or, there was a rock band that was, fighting against it. I mean, can't remember who it was.
I feel like there's a lot, you know, everybody hates them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one that was like offering refunds or some shit like that. I can't remember who it was.
That's pretty good.
But yeah, I mean, they basically have a monopoly on it. And these days everyone knows when you buy a ticket, if it's $25, it's actually $50 because you pay almost just as much in their bullshit service fees.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are we doing? And you even used to be able to just go to the box office and get around those fees. But even if you go to the box office now, there's still fees. It's like, what
sucks.
Is the service you provide?
It sucks when they squeeze artists like that because also like, I guess in any venue that's like a Live Nation owned venue or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know how true this is, but I've definitely heard from artists of venues taking a cut of the merch.
Mm.
So how crazy is that? So like
I would not be happy about that.
But some venues, like, it's just policy. And if you want to play them, you have to do it. And so you're sitting there after the show and, you know, you sell a T-shirt that normally maybe should be $25. Instead, that T-shirt's going to be $40 because they want a cut.
Yep.
And the whole argument usually is like, well, if you, how is it fair that you get a cut of the merch, but we don't get a cut of the bar? Like, we should get a cut of the bar.
Absolutely. Why do you think people are showing up? They're not showing up because of the venue. They're showing up because of the artist.
It's true. That's a good point. I mean, everything is really, really fucked up there. And hopefully, like, there can be steps taken to make it more equitable. I personally,
it's like a fucking, like a mafia, like taking a cut, like demanding the cut.
Well, it's the story in all media where like when all these companies are just too big. Again, we're going to get into this in the second half for pretty in depth, I think. But
sure,
it's just that these companies are just too big and like they have too much power. They have too much control. And there's like the only who can even break them up. The only people who can break them up are the federal government. there's no competing against them.
Yeah, because we're in these late stages of capitalism where it's almost impossible to start a new company that can compete with that because they have so much money and they can just devour you, you know. Yeah. You know, any small business at whatever startup that actually gains momentum typically gets bought out.
Well, I was going to say, and monopolies. That's even considered like, and that's success.
Yeah, and that's if they have the seed funding to even get something like that off the ground.
Yeah,
it's true. It's,
I mean, I think
it's a bad state.
No, yeah, it's not, things are all fucky. Capitalism,
all fucky.
That's how it goes. One of those companies that is at the top and kind of has a chokehold on media, one of the few, is Warner Brothers Discovery. Yeah. You know, let's call them what they are, Warner Brothers Discovery.
Sure.
And apparently on their
merger.
Yeah, on their Q1 earnings call, I think, or some sort of call, CEO David Zaslav did not even mention the writer's strike. Like, literally, it was an hour long call, not one single mention of the WGA strike. But he told CNBC that he believes, quote, a love for working will end it. That's like so tone deaf and crazy, dude. Is. Like, for a CEO who makes $250 million a year to be like, a love for working is going to make them come back. No, dude, it's because they're going to be like broke and not able to pay any rent, right? And you're going to choke them out. That's maybe why people will come back.
How did these corpos not understand that people don't like working? Like, people work because they have to.
Yeah.
Like, if I just had all the money in the world, or, you know, enough that I didn't have to work, guess what? I wouldn't work. Sorry.
It's like, such a thing. Like, people, I sort of agree with you. I think people do like to work on their things, own things that they love.
Yeah.
And a lot, it's not everybody who works for Warner Brothers Discovery does it because they love Warner Brothers Discovery. That's not how shit works, man. Like, you love to work, David Zaslav, because you make so much fucking money.
Yeah, and like, your work is probably just like rubbing elbows and talking to people all the time and going to swanky ass parties. And
yes, like, there is a lot of pressure, sure, to being a CEO. Cause, like, again, stuff like this, like, you know, we're some stupid idiots just like talking about him. Right. So there is a lot of pressure, obviously, but let's not pretend that, like, that's, it's just a silly thing to say. A love for working is going to end the strike. Come on, man.
It's
like,
super tone deaf.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But, you know, That's why the sizzle reel keeps going, is because we have a love for work. We have a love for working on the show.
It's 100% it.
Let's get to this last thing and kind of keep this first half pretty short, because I think there's a lot of strike stuff to jump into in the second half. You put this one in here. What is this?
Oh, yeah. So this is this was posted on r/editors. And I think someone else, basically, I don't know if it's a podcast, but they did an interview with someone about the future of video editing with the AI.
Wait, so this is where we've gotten to? We're plugging other pods on the show.
Hey, man, it's good content.
I'm just joking.
I think the user was AV Guru or something like that. But
shout out AV Guru.
But within this thread,
says Reed Kimball.
Reed Kimball.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, shout out AV Guru.
Yeah. Within that thread, there was a, because it was about AI, a user named Dick Laser posted about how they had just recently used AI in one of their workflows. They said, I actually just used 11 Labs to clone a voiceover I was editing. I needed a phrase redone and didn't feel like waiting for the guy to redo it. So I just cloned his voice, spit out several versions, and chose the best. Nobody noticed. And I just wanted to kind of touch on the ethics of using an AI in your post workflow in this kind of.
Okay, that's very interesting. Yeah,
because
I will say, well, when you put this in the rundown, I was like, didn't we talk about this like a year ago? But we talked about it in a very different way.
Yeah, this is slightly different, because I think in the past we talked about someone had passed away.
Yeah, and they needed like a line redone for something or something like that.
Yeah.
Or maybe they, what it was they used their voice to read a quote that they had said for an audiobook or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, that's
like
what that. It was. So it's a little bit different. In this situation, I'm just curious how you feel and if you think this is okay. Because for me, like, I'm kind of 50-50. I can see why it is maybe not 100% kosher. But at the same time, when you know, it's like, okay, we can use AI to make people say something that they didn't say. Well, guess what? We're editors. We can do that without AI. We, you know, that's one of the main parts of our job, is cutting up what someone says, in not necessarily always like rephrasing it. Our goal is usually to stay true to their statement, but clean up how it's said.
Right. I'm torn on this one.
Yeah, I am too.
I think that here's what I think. Here's where I think this person went wrong. They said, you know, I needed a phrase redone and I didn't feel like waiting for the guy to redo it. I think if you hit up, say, I don't know who the decision makers were on this,
sure.
but like if you were just an editor and the producer was like, hey, like it just depends who was making the decisions. If this person was editing it and also producing it and direct doing everything, one man banding it.
Yeah.
Then I think is just as long as everyone's on the same page, it's fucking fine. Like if you hit up the guy and go, hey, I know like this is like, you know, a important thing that we need to have done right away and time is of the essence.
Yes.
And I know that we didn't expect you to have to redo things. So I'm sure you're busy. Totally cool. I have these couple things that I used this program to make. Check out these bytes. Tell me if you're cool with us using this.
Yeah.
And as long as like the VO artist is cool with using it, I guess it also depends on what kind of contract they signed with the VO artist. Sure. Like, is the VO artist getting paid extra to redo this stuff or are they pro bono going to redo it? Because like, as long as it doesn't affect their pay.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as everyone's on board, I'm fine with this kind of tech being used.
So for you, it's about consent.
Yeah. I don't need someone going behind the artist's back to use their, you know, voice and their likeness in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
I pretty much land in the same place as long as you're not taking money out of their pocket. Like if they're getting paid the same rate either way, whether they do the pickups or not, I don't have as much of an issue with it. Because honestly it's now they don't have to do any extra work and they still get paid the same. I guess there's also some ethical dilemma depending on what the AI is like. Are they using his voice or their voice to train this model further? And like, does this AI keep a database, you know, with this person's voice and likeness? I just don't know, but it's another layer to be worried about.
Right. Yeah. That you're right. That makes sense because like there are no really established kind of rules yet, I guess, like in AI and then all that. I mean, there are, but they're so loose right now that like you don't know what's going to happen. Like people just like ship these programs and they like do these incredible things. And I don't know. I guess we'll end up seeing what happens. I really don't know how like the wild right now we're in the wild west of AI. I don't 100%. Know how it's going to get regulated.
It's going to be another 10 years.
Maybe even more because the government hasn't proved that they can like
we're going to have to rely on Europe to pass legislation and hopefully
probably,
you know, force these companies.
I think in America, what the only way that anything would happen is they'd have to privatize it, which is like frustrating.
Yeah. And like, it's weird because it seems like it would be a kind of slam dunk bipartisan issue.
I think it is. I just think that the people who like, I literally don't think they understand it. So like,
I mean, we do have a bunch of 80-year-olds running the country.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think that they don't really get it at all. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's why 10 years, you're right. Maybe in 10 years there will be people who understand it. But right now they're like, so was TikTok on Wi-Fi? And you're like, could be, I guess.
Sure.
Like, but I don't know, man. It's interesting. Yeah. What's your big picture final verdict on this? Good, cool to do or not cool to do?
I think ultimately it's
in the way this person did it.
In the way this person did it, I don't have too much of an issue. I wouldn't have posted about it. I wouldn't have said anything about it, honestly. So like that kind of tells you where I am on it is I would have done it, but I wouldn't have told people that I did it. Because to me, it really isn't different enough from just chopping someone's sentences up. You know, it's the kind of stuff that we already do. And I think the other big thing is the way I would use it is only if they like kind of flubbed a line or something. And I think I could have them deliver that same line better. I don't want to put any words in their mouth that they didn't right. actually say.
Cool. Yeah, I think I mostly agree with that. Pretty much 100% agree with it. Any last things you want to touch on before we get to this break? Because we got some WGA stuff to talk about.
No, I think we're in pretty good shape here. And we'll see you on the other side.
All right. See you on the other side.
Welcome back, Sizzlers.
Welcome.
You know, this entire second half is going to be dedicated to
a very heavy topic.
Yes.
But we're going to smile the entire time that we do it.
Yeah. And, you know,
if you smile and talk, you sound different.
It's true. 100%.
That's how we're going to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be really weird. I'm serious. I smile the whole time.
like a fence. We are a couple of white picketers.
That's right.
We are.
I can't feel my face because I'm smiling.
We're talking about the writer's strike. Now, neither of us are writers and neither of us are on strike. So this is
we were on strike during the break.
Well, that's true.
And then the show came back.
It was a 4-hour strike.
I mean,
actually.
What can I say? I guess I just have a love for working. That's what brought me back from the break.
You yearn for the mines.
I yearn for the mines. Yeah, neither of us are writers. Neither of us are union members of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I guess.
But this affects our industry.
Yeah, this affects the industry. And it's kind of like you can't have a media focused podcast without even discussing it. And I know we've talked about it briefly the last couple of weeks, but decided to dedicate a whole chunk of the show to it this mm-hmm. week. Again, you know, we're recording this on a Friday, so yeah. Who knows what happened over the weekends. Hopefully we're not like too out of touch at this point, but
hey, look,
I think we'll have some good things to say.
If you're listening to this on Monday, the 8th, well, come join us tomorrow on Tuesday, yes. May 9th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 120 Jewell Street in
That's
Brooklyn
right.
at the Broadway stages.
We'll be there.
We'll be picketing.
We will be picketing. Well, we'll at least be marching with them and talking to
well,
them.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have any signs.
Yeah. But it'll be cool. I mean, also, you know, meet some writers, maybe pick up some work.
Yeah, why not?
Sorry, I was fucked up. But no, yeah, we'll be there. The Broadway stage is on Jewell Street, right? 120?
120.
Yeah, and then if you actually are interested, you know what? Let's get into it. This is a great starting point. So the WGA, they have a website set up for this. It's WGAContract2023.org. So that's WGAContract2023.org. It's going to have a lot of information on the strike and kind of the history of the WGA and all that kind of stuff. And they also have a schedule and of where they're going to be picketing. Schedules, locations, both West Coast and East Coast.
Yep.
So
well New York, organized.
Yeah, very well organized. New York, there's a ton of stuff. LA, obviously, there's a ton of stuff. So if you want to support, that's one way to do it. I was on TikTok. I've got some writers whose stuff comes up on my TikTok all the time, mm-hmm. and they actually addressed a comment that someone left, and it was like, hey, I originally had booked this tour of like the studios for this month. Some point someone was visiting LA, they wanted to do a studio tour, and they were like, what should I like cancel this tour, or like what should I do?
Yeah.
And the guy was like, no, I mean, you can still go on it, but like just know that, you know, we're not going to be there or whatever.
Yeah.
And someone in the comments was like, you should cancel it. Instead, you should go march with them.
100%.
And then you could like meet them. And it's like a better story because you actually get to meet the people who write the stuff you like instead of just being, you know, caddied around a lot or something.
Sure.
So I don't know. It could be cool to go over there and talk to some people.
I was thinking maybe we could be proactive about it and we'll start a GoFundMe. Now, we're not starting the GoFundMe for the writers, though. We're starting their GoFundMe for us to support the writers.
Yes.
So all the money will go to us.
And then we'll figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And some of it might go to them.
That's going to be at sizzlerealganglewebsite.com/GoFundMe. Yeah, just look for that.
Yeah, sizzlerealganglewebsite.com/WJContract2023. It's like, it's going to be, I don't know. Yeah. You just click on it. Just put your credit card info in. No more questions. So Chris, I know you and I were both kind of reading a little bit about this. We have the current proposals pulled up. I know we have that, and we have a little bit of the history of the strike, and we got some stats on stuff. So, I don't know, where do you want to start, somewhere specific, or?
I feel like we should probably start with the strike history a little bit.
I pulled up a couple dates for the ones that I want to talk about. The first one I pulled up was 1953. This is when the Writers Guild at the time, they struck the Alliance of Television Film Producers for 13 weeks.
Yes.
And this was when they got their first rights to residuals for reruns. So yep. they got paid for up to 5 reruns.
Yep.
Things have come a long way since then. But I thought that that was kind of an interesting thing. And that's why I kind of pulled that. They also secured control of credits and TV and minimum compensations and a lot of other things. But those were kind of the big ones that stuck out to me. I thought that was kind of nuts that, you know, they set the rate at 5 reruns, because
That's really not much at all.
It's weird. Yeah. Now, yeah. like,
I mean, it's better than zero.
Yeah. But there's episodes of Seinfeld that have probably played like thousands of times.
Oh, sure. I mean, think about a show like MASH that's, yeah. you know, been yeah. running for yeah, 40 years, point. Whatever. yeah. Then in 1960, the Writers Guild struck again, this time for 22 weeks. They were able to win first residuals for theatrical motion pictures. It paid 1.2% of the license fee when features were licensed to television. So I guess in the past rerun, you know, when a movie moved to television,
yeah.
There were no residuals for the writers until the 60s.
There were there's a lot. This is a very like dense timeline, and there's a lot of stuff. So there's definitely things that we're skipping just for the sake of kind of keeping it a little bit surface level.
Yeah,
but the next
brief
one,
history.
Yeah, the next one I picked was 1973. Did you have something before that or no?
No, I think 1973 is another. I'm really honestly just focusing for the most part on when they actually struck.
Yeah.
Because there have been a couple times where a vote to strike has passed, but they were able to come to terms before actually striking.
Yeah.
And you know that kind of happens a lot. Or
right.
Or they've been able to gain concessions without
having
you know,
to strike
without even going to the vote. Yes.
In 1973, they struck for 4 months.
Yep.
And this time they struck the association. What probably used to be the ATFP, Alliance of Television Film Producers. I know at this point it was the Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers.
Yes.
The AMPTP, which is still around. They struck them for 4 months. And in this one, they gained the establishment of an independent health fund,
yes.
which is cool. I mean, that's kind of weird that it took until 73 to do it, but they did that. And another thing that I thought was interesting was, you know, they earned points on distribution or something like that for video cassette sales. And it says pay television. So I guess that's like HBO or paid channels. But what's interesting to me is that they did this in anticipation of the future emergence of that type of distribution. So that's it's kind of, you know, it's come back around a few times now that writers have to be forward thinking. And the Guild specifically always thinks about what's happening with distribution. And that, I think that's going to be a bigger part of this conversation later in a few minutes. But I thought that was interesting that they were like, hey, video cassettes are a thing now and people are like paying for TV kind of channels on demand or whatever, not on demand, but paying for TV channels.
Mm-hmm.
If this is going to take off, we need to see points on it, or we need to see like compensation. So I thought that was a really interesting wrinkle in that 1973 strike. They also,
so instead of just getting money for the theatrical releases, whatever the box office, also getting paid for sales.
It releases on tape.
Yeah, on home video.
Which, you know, I think in a way that right there is the like very spine of this push and pull between the Writers Guild and the producers pretty much now for 50 years, because it's every time a new format emerges, one tries to, the AMPTP tries to
keep it all,
monopolize it and monetize it, and the writers go, no, we want a chunk, right? So I don't know, that was 73. The other one I have is 07-08, but you have anything in between then?
I do. In 1981, the guild struck for 13 weeks, and they were able to get concessions for made-for-pay television programs. They also got terms for reuse of television programs on basic cable channels. That was changed from fixed residuals to 1.2% of the distributor's gross receipts.
So again, same idea, right? It's like now basic cable is starting to become more of a thing. So yes. They go, okay, if you're going to show our shit there, we also want some money for you showing our work there.
Yes. You know? Then again, in 1988, the guild struck for 22 weeks, which was, I think it's tied for the longest strike in history. I think they've had two 22-week strikes. Maybe this was like longer by a day or two. Mm-hmm. Gains for that included an increase in residuals for reuse of free television product on basic cable to 2% of the license fees. They got some residuals for made for basic cable products. They got some improvements in creative rights for the writers on original screenplays and TV movies. They were able to establish a committee on the professional status of writers to conduct talks about creative rights. And then along with the Directors Guild and with the Screen Actors Guild, the Writers Guild won an agreement from the AMPTP to fund a tri-guild audit program through which the guilds can assure the revenue-based residuals are paid correctly. So basically kind of like team, not quite a super guild, but like they were all able to, those unions were able to work together a little bit more to make each other stronger.
And to like keep the AMPTP in check.
Yes.
That seems like an interesting strike because that one wasn't actually, it seems like based around new formats of mm-hmm. media, which is, you know, to me, I think what most of the strikes revolve around new media formats.
Yeah.
1988 was just like straight up like, hey, okay, we're not getting paid enough. Yeah. And like the AMPTP seems to be like fucking everyone up a little bit. So let's all figure out what's going on.
The one last little interesting part about the 88 strike is the guild agreed to discounts for syndication reuse of certain 1-hour dramatic primetime network series. So that's a very specific genre right there, I guess. But it is still interesting that, you know, the guild gave something back. That's the first time that they've really mentioned something like that.
Right. I don't know. Was there other stuff before the 07-08 one, or was the 07-08 one the next one? I think that it was the next one.
I think that was the next one.
I think
one.
They kept kind of, you know, reaching new, agreements without having to strike.
Sure. I'll mention 2001, just because this is kind of in line with
where we are now.
With the new media. In 2001, the Guild gained its first ever residual for internet use of films and TV, originally produced for a different market. They got a 1.2% of license fee residual for internet rentals, subscription video on demand.
For it to be easier to understand, SVOD, right? Subscription video on demand, better known as SVOD. That's very interesting to me because it's like 2001 mm-hmm. to think about internet rentals. Like that's very far ahead of when they actually became in vogue, sort of, you know, because I feel like it wasn't another 10 plus years until like internet rental started being a thing, really.
Yeah,
because,
absolutely.
Like, I know in 2001, like, we were still going to Blockbuster, and I feel like, I mean, even in like 2005, I'm still going to Blockbuster.
In 2001, you know? I still had dial-up internet. You know,
yeah, like, so
Yeah, I mean, maybe I could order a DVD through Netflix at that point in time, but there was certainly no streaming, really. I was still playing with Flash videos.
I think that one thing that the Writers Guild is always on top of is like kind of future proofing where their work is gonna go.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because that's I don't know, it's pretty impressive, and it makes me kind of think about what's happening now. In 07-08, obviously, you know, probably that's remember
probably the most famous one for people of our lifetime,
right? Yeah, they struck for 100 days, and again they struck the AMPTP. Gains for that included MBA coverage of content made for new media.
And that's minimum basic agreement.
Right. So they, at that point, this is actually where the term new media, and I could say in quotes, comes in, because this is like new media ended up being streaming. So they were like, we don't know what to call it. Let's call it new media. And residuals for reuse on new media platforms, including digital downloads and use on ad-supported internet services.
Yeah.
This is 07, 08, man. So this is crazy. Again, like, they're way ahead of it, because I would argue that it wasn't until the last maybe, you know, like, maybe eight years ago, it was like, okay, now this shit is common. I feel like in 07, it wasn't like super common to like...
It was still pretty new. Look, I mean, YouTube had just become a thing in 2005. And yeah. I don't even know if it was ad supported at that point or if it was just like a completely free Google product.
Yeah.
But, you know, the writers were at least, they had the foresight to realize where this was going.
Right.
And I don't know if, I don't think Netflix was streaming by that point, but they were probably ramping that up or getting ready to.
Yeah. I think that like... For me, if I recall correctly, maybe around 2009 or 2010 is when I first really started using any streaming stuff. Like, I remember streaming stuff on Hulu a lot in like 2009, 2010.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I think that was
right.
One of the first ones. Because I remember watching Modern Family a lot back then.
So Netflix first started streaming, they first announced it in January 2007.
Right. Okay, reference. So that makes sense. And then they were like, oh shit, this is coming up quick. Time to... renegotiate. Mm-hmm. Right. I just think that, you know, it's interesting because in 2001 it was just covering internet rentals, and in order, you'd think like anyone in their right mind would go, oh, okay, yeah, you had that covering internet rentals, yeah, we'll just carry that over. I mean, that makes sense because we didn't know this was coming, but they had to like actually actively stop working and strike,
yeah,
to get this to apply to new media, which is streaming, which is fucking the same thing, yeah, as internet rentals.
Yeah,
like, what the fuck?
It's basically semantics at that point.
Yeah. And so that was 07, 08. And I think since then, shit has been relatively chill.
Yeah.
They gained an
increase in their pension fund contribution by their employers in 2011. They negotiated minimums for streaming shows on high budgets, SVOD, you know, I don't want to say small things because all these, yeah, things add up and they matter, but nothing that they had to strike over. Then in 2017, the guild actually took a strike authorization vote. It was over 96% yes, mm-hmm, over necessary increases to the health fund, but they ended up not striking. So they were able to get what they were asking for without striking on that one.
Yeah. And so that kind of takes us to today. If you again go to WGAcontract2023.org, you can look up the current status of all of this stuff. The proposals that we're looking at are, this is accurate as of May 1st, 2023. I'm sure they'll upload an amended PDF at some point once they, yeah, hear back or once they have their other meetings. And this includes, it's basically a two column breakdown. The first column is all of the WGA proposals, and the second column is all of the offers from the AMPTP.
Yes.
Before we really get into it, I think it's fascinating that the AMPTP is the Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers, and the WGA is the Writers Guild, because at its core, you know, like, even when you first start in any media industry position, right? For us, like editing, you know,
mm-hmm,
you always, a producer is the one telling you what to do.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking producers. They're very important. I kind of see myself as one, right? But like, when they're telling you what to do, one of the first kind of mental kind of spots you get into is like me versus producer.
Oh,
you go,
yeah.
Oh, editor versus producer. Ah, oh, this producer, man, they don't know what they're doing. They're telling me what to do. Da, 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 da. I think it's just very fascinating that even like at the highest level right now, this strike is happening. It's still writers versus, yeah, producers. Well, so it's pretty interesting.
Even, you know, when I was in news as an editor, that's my first real professional editing job. The producers were fucking like the worst part of the job because, yeah, you know, they're the ones literally telling us what to do. But, and this isn't the case all, you know, across the industry, but at least in news, producers, they don't know shit about video. Like they're news producers, really,
right,
more than video producers, but they're still ultimately telling you what to show. Yeah. But they just don't have a basic understanding of how things work.
Yeah.
From the technical side.
I just think it, yeah. And it's just funny that basically you have
it just stays the same like throughout
right throughout it, like, every level it's,
yeah
it's got it's dressed up differently and they use different terms, but at the end of the day it's a tug of war between an associate, a collective of writers and a collective of producers, and they're just pulling at the same rope.
Yep.
So this document has all these proposals. One thing that I found, they cover a lot of things. They cover minimums, they cover features, they cover episodic television, streaming, pension and health, AI, and there's a lot of stuff. I thought it was interesting how of a lot of, I don't know how many proposals are in here. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 proposals. Of those 15, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 were basically the AMPTP came back and the offer was rejected the proposal, refused to make a counter.
Yes.
And I'm including in that when they countered with they reject the proposal, but countered with having meetings, because that's basically saying we're refusing to make a counter. So we can go through a couple of these proposals that were rejected. I kind of want to start with the AI one, because I think this is it's kind of interesting. We talked about AI a lot last week. It obviously is affecting, you know, the media industry and pretty much every industry, but media industry specifically sure. is having a lot of issues with it. The proposal was to regulate the use of artificial intelligence on MBA covered projects. MBA is a
minimum basic agreement.
Minimum basic agreement. So basically regulating the use of artificial intelligence on projects. It's mm-hmm. saying that AI cannot write or rewrite literary material, cannot be used as source material, and MBA covered material cannot be used to train AI. So basically they're saying, hey, we just want to regulate AI right now while it's in its nascent stages and it's wild west of AI. We want to regulate this shit.
Yeah.
So it doesn't like, so it can't use our work to fuck us more or
yeah,
less.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not only you can't use an AI to write scripts. It's you can't use our scripts that we've written in the past to even train an AI
yeah.
to do something like that.
Right. And I think, you know, when it came to visual AI models, there was a lot of controversy about that where photographers like Getty photographers, like, you know, we didn't, you weren't, Getty was, you were not allowed to use our libraries to train your models.
Yeah.
And some of them would even have the Getty watermark built in.
100%.
Obviously they used them. All in all, the AMPTP rejected the proposal, but they countered by offering annual meetings to discuss advancements in technology, which is just like the most fucking like transparent, like bullshit, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, no.
It's like, no, we're not going to do that. But like, you can ask us again in a year.
Yeah,
we're like, going to tell you no again. But then you can ask us again the year after. Yeah,
like every year you can talk to us about how you're concerned about this.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous.
And then, you know, between this and obviously the streaming or new media, whatever we want to call it, that's really, I think, where we're going to see the impasse more than anywhere else.
Yeah.
Like I think it's really going to be the AI component that they're going to really struggle. The AMPTP is going to really, really fight back against
yeah.
because that is just such a moneymaker for them. If they're able to hang on to that, if you can create things without paying writers,
yeah.
that's a gold mine for those greedy executives.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that you think that. I don't think that's going to be as much of a thing. I have a feeling that the AMPTP are going to bend on that pretty quickly. I don't
you
think
that, so.
Yeah, I don't think that they're. I don't think that they're gonna. Because like, I mean, you can't. How are you gonna in like good faith, like say that no, we're gonna train it on your work? I don't know. I don't think the artificial intelligence will be that big of a thing. I feel like they'll meet them at some point, right?
I don't know. I just think that it's such a potential moneymaker, and that's what this whole thing is about. It's about money.
Yeah.
That, you know, plain and simple. And we're still in such an early stage of AI that I, you know, they have giant dollar signs as pupils right now.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to fight that because that, We're seeing right now AI that can write scripts. Maybe they're not amazing, but think about what they can do in 10 years, especially if they're trained off of real movies that have been created and are, you know, considered great. And like that's, I think that's one of the easiest steps for AI to make an improvement in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I hope the WGA gets now, what they're asking for.
See, but here's what I'm curious about is if they do meet that demand, can a writer in the guild use an AI to write something for themselves?
Probably not, right?
Well, I don't know. They're saying the AMPTP can't, but are they saying that the writers can't either?
No, they're saying that AI cannot write or rewrite literary material and cannot be used as, can't be used as source, or no, the projects that they've written can't be used as source material. Yeah, it's interesting because it's like, I mean,
it also says AI can't write literary material.
Yeah,
based on anything.
I think that they're just gonna, it's a very sticky wicket. Because, you know, we've never been here. So, like, literally, we've never been here. And there's no guiding, established, like, quote unquote, truth for this.
Like you said, it's the Wild West.
Yeah. We don't even have any sort of established law. We don't have nothing that at a federal level has been established about it. So it's just very interesting. I guess we'll see what happens. For me, one other thing that's interesting in this, and I think we're mostly going to stick to the proposals that AMPTP just flat out rejected because we don't have, you know, can't talk about this the whole time. And to be totally frank, there is like a lot of very dense language in here that's like super specific Hollywood that I don't know.
There is one proposal that has been counter offered that I do think is interesting, and it's the streaming features. Streaming features are like features made for Netflix or for Hulu, you know, something that it does not have a theatrical release.
Yeah.
Those features with a budget of $12 million or more would receive full theatrical terms, including better initial compensation and residuals. So basically, if it's a feature length film, with a budget over $12 million, it doesn't matter if you're not releasing it in the theaters, you still have to abide by those standard rules for theatrical releases.
That seems good to me.
I think that's completely fair because
I've talked to so many people who don't go to theaters anymore.
Yeah.
Period. Like they don't. And I, you know, if you've heard any past episodes of the show, I'm always just like, I think people should go to theaters more. If this passes, then sure, then don't go to theaters. I don't give a fuck. But I think part of the reason what makes it so appealing for them to produce films that go on to streaming is that they don't have to treat them the same. And that's why they just push them straight to the streams.
Exactly. Because you can make more money there because you're not paying the writers the same amount of money.
I wonder if that $12 million number was thought of with the idea of meeting someone part way.
I would guess
because
so.
The AMPTP came back and said, okay, let's do programs that are 96 plus minutes with a budget of 40 million or more. And then you would receive 9% increase to your initial compensation. And no improvement or residual. So obviously very far apart, I think. But those are both starting points, right? Because this is literally status as of May 1st, the first day of the strike. So those are the starting points. Maybe they'll come to the table and, you know, meet halfway. You know, again, I'm with the WGA on that one. I think like it's the same idea as the past strikes. It's the same idea as 07-08, 1973, 1953. It's just theaters are now not really being used. And people only watch movies at home. So we need to change the idea of compensation for those films because they still are very high quality films.
Yeah, absolutely.
Films that are released.
People are just consuming them in different ways, but guess what? They're still making equivalent money.
One thing that is also kind of has to do with features, they had a proposal for weekly pay. 50% pay upon commencement and remaining 50% to be paid out weekly over the writing period. They rejected that proposal and refused to make a counter. So I don't know how things are done now, but I imagine it's, there is probably no standard for that kind of stuff. It's just however you negotiate. To make it standard to do 50% up front and 50% paid out weekly over the writing period, I think that's very reasonable.
I think that's pretty reasonable. I wouldn't be upset if the WGA was able to amend that to, 50% paid biweekly or whatever, something very small. But ultimately, I feel like that's very standard, especially for like any freelance artist.
Yeah.
50% upfront is the standard. Like, that's how you prevent yourself from getting screwed.
Well, and then the other kind of part that I kind of left out is that this only applies if a writer is paid less than 250% of minimum, right? So yes. If you make 2.5x minimum or less, then you're automatically opted into that. If you make more on that project, which the highest paid writers probably do, they can opt into it if they want. They can opt into weekly pay. They don't have to. So again, like, that just seems very reasonable.
That seems super reasonable.
Reject it and refuse to make a counter is pretty lame. When it comes to, you have anything else on features before I get to episodics?
No, nothing left. Nothing else on features. For
episodic television, a couple other things that were rejected flat out was, I don't know. This one says minimums in post-production. So it says NBA weekly minimums during post. That's all it says. I'm assuming that means a weekly minimum fee that the writer would receive during post-production. Again, like, I just am not entrenched in Hollywood enough to really understand what this means.
Sure.
I think that's what it means. If that is what it means and they reject that completely, that's kind of lame. But, I mean, I guess I understand like that it's post and you maybe don't need the writer, but still, I think you should have one writer during post. And that's kind of what they actually proposed a couple other things for the duration or regarding duration of employment. So post green light writer's rooms. Let's start with pre green light writer's rooms. So if a project hasn't been green lit, they ask for a minimum staff guarantee that the minimum staff are guaranteed at least 10 consecutive weeks of work. So you have a guaranteed minimum of 10 consecutive weeks on pre-greenlit stuff. So that means if you are hired, you've got 10 weeks to write on this.
Very reasonable.
It's not like, hey, we just need you for like 3 days and then you're gone, like, or whatever. It's not like you get 1 week to write it and then that's it. You get 10 weeks, which that's cool. Two and a half months.
Absolutely.
Once something has been greenlit, so for post greenlit rooms, writers on staff must get at least 3 weeks per episode. So, for example, if you have a series that is being written that is, six episodes, 6 times 3, 18. So there's going to be 18 weeks of writing to do on that show.
Yes.
Half of the minimum staff must be employed through production. So you have to employ them through the whole production process after the show is written. So at least half. And then one writer must be employed through post. So you must keep one writer on through post production. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you have questions. Sometimes the writer would be very useful to have in post. And again, that writer would be, making a weekly minimum during post. Either way, all of that was rejected.
Yep. So not even countered.
Yeah. So it's just like they want to, not set any boundaries on that and be able to hire and fire at will, it seems like. I'm with WJ on that one. And then, I don't know, Chris, you want to talk about this writer's room one? It says preserving the writer's room.
Sure.
Episodic television.
Sure. So this one for pre-greenlight rooms, the minimum staff would be 6 writers, and that includes 4 writer producers, which the writer producer title is very interesting to me. I don't know
where
do they fall? Which guild are they in? Are
Who
they
knows?
In both?
They probably might be in both.
I don't know. That's a complicated life.
Yeah.
And then once the series is greenlit, It would, the proposal would require one writer per episode, up to six episodes, then one additional writer required for each two episodes after six, up to a maximum of 12 writers. So if you have if you have eight episodes, then you would have to hire at least two writers. Is that right?
No, if you have eight episodes, you'd have to, it requires at least seven writers, and four of them are writer producers.
Gosh, sorry. Yeah, right. I started with.
No, no, you're good. So like basically, again, those six episodes, let's say that we're making a six episode series. That means you need to have six writers.
Yes.
And four of them need to be writer producers. And under like what would be ideal for WGA, those six writers would each have 3 weeks to write that episode.
Yeah.
So that room could actually only be 3 weeks long because each writer is working on one episode. So that, you know, that would work.
Yeah. If it's 10 episodes, you would need eight writers and five writer producers. If it's 12 episodes, you would need nine writers and six writer producers, and yes, so on. For every two episodes,
you need to hire an additional writer.
Yes.
Right. It's, it can get a little convoluted. It's just talking about it, but if you see it written out, it makes a lot more sense. And if you kind of just draw it and break it down, it makes a lot more sense. And I mean, those all seem really fucking realistic. And that's why it's kind of frustrating that like there's not even a counter to those things. And again, this is just that's according to day one, right? It's where they started.
Yes.
Eventually they got a fucking counter. Cause like, that's not even fair, man. To like, to not even counter is lame. Like, it's like, come on, dude. These people are just asking for very reasonable things. I guess the last one that I have that I want to talk about, and then if you have anything else, but is the pension and health thing. So this one refers to writing teams, I think. So it says each member of a team, which I guess would be a writing team, each member of a writing team gets pension and health contributions as if they were writing as an individual. So let's say, for example, there's a writing team of two people and they write everything together. All they're asking for is for each person in that team to be treated as an individual when it comes to pension and health. They rejected the proposal. So I guess that means that if someone writes in a team and there's two people, but they like split the credit and they both write as one team, they have to split the contributions to pension and health. Like, so they each get treated as half a person.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
What the hell's up with that?
That's absolutely insane.
And I think to reject that is really fucking petty, because it's like that seems like it makes fucking, how many fucking writers teams are out there? Like, how much does this really affect your fucking bottom line, dude?
Well, I mean,
just like, treat them like people.
Just in general, when would you ever hire a team and pay them as one person?
Yeah.
Like, and it just doesn't,
you know,
track.
The payment, whatever, but like, figure the payment out however you want. You know what I mean? Like, okay, if they're cool with
their
it.
Their health fund, their pension fund.
But the health and pension, that's what really gets me. It's like, how do you expect two people to share a pension? That doesn't work that way. Like, it's fucking crazy. So I don't know. I thought that was pretty lame. I don't know if you have any other things you want to touch on in this before we get to big picture kind of stuff.
I think what I'd like to touch on is what their tentative agreements are so far. And then after that, kind of like how far apart they are just based on the numbers. So some of the tentative agreements so far include script fees for staff writers. They would receive script fees on top of their weeklies. Options and exclusivity. They would increase their earning cap from $325,000 to $350,000. The PNH diversion, Writers Guild option to divert 0.5% of negotiated minimums increases to pension or health fund, and broadcast reruns, which would allow one additional free promotional run for new made for broadcast series, which is a little over my head if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah, there's a lot of like I said earlier, there's a lot of like Hollywood terms in this that are like, you know, it would be cool to get like an agent on the show at some point to help us like unpack what a lot of this shit is. And yeah, I mean, if you are listening and we got something wrong, you know,
we definitely did.
SizzleRealGang@gmail.com. Just send us or call in 332-333-4361. Leave a message about what we misunderstood.
Yeah.
Because we definitely misunderstood a lot of shit.
This is basically just us trying to wrap our heads around the strike and understand it a little bit better.
Trying to parse it. You know what I'm saying?
And then at the very bottom, talking about cost, the current Writers Guild proposals would gain writers approximately $429 million per year, and AMPTP's offer is approximately $86 million per year, 48% from which is, or 40%, 48% of which is from the minimums increase. This is such legalese.
So,
so basically, they're $340 million apart per year in contract talks right now.
And half of what AMPTP is proposing comes from just increasing their minimum comps, minimum compensations or whatever. So, or I don't know, or minimum residuals or something like that. I don't know. Again, like, I'm glad I'm not a writer, no offense, but fight the good fight, guys. We're right there with you. A couple big picture things that I think are interesting. So, 10 years ago, in 2013, 2014, 33% of TV writers were paid minimum, and now 49% of them work at minimum. We've talked about it a lot before on the show. I think we've called it, or I know I've called it this, the race to the bottom.
Yeah.
I feel like it happens in post-production. I know we're like non-union, so we're, you know, maybe part of the problem or whatever, but it definitely happens in post, where, like, you know, people just undercut each other until like it becomes untenable. And I think, you know, it's maybe it's kind of happening in the writing world. I don't know. The WGA, I mean, that's crazy. It's kind of crazy that 49, like basically half of the working writers in the guild work for the minimum, you know,
that's
minimum level.
Yeah. I mean, that's insane. Like, imagine if, half of the world,
half of America
worked at minimum wage.
Yeah.
Like, it's simply not sustainable. I mean,
I wonder how much of America does work for minimum wage.
I don't know.
Let me look it up.
Quick little research.
Yeah, how many Americans work for minimum wage? It says at least 1.1 million Americans earn less than or equal to the federal minimum wage.
Okay.
So not a lot. 1.4% of all hourly paid workers, according to this.
That's
1%.
1%.
As compared to 49%.
49%.
Yeah, 49% of Americans worked for minimum wage. We'd have a problem.
I mean, we already do. And like, I mean, you can see the middle class is already shrinking in America.
Yeah.
Okay, like, this is just untenable for writers to... Yeah. If you're a writer in Hollywood, there is a 50-50 chance that you are working for the minimum.
Yeah.
Like, that is not sustainable.
Which is, I mean, shout out to the union for negotiating a minimum that is livable, I guess, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how livable it is, but, it, you know, it's better than, you know, some non-union jobs, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But again, yeah, you can't. There's a reason it's a minimum. You know what I'm saying? I think, you know, you talked about the disappearing middle class, and I know we talked about that in the first half of the show a little bit, and, you know, kind of just to put a bow on everything, I'm looking at this graph that kind of talks about the operating profits in the entertainment segment, and, you know, it goes into the billions, but in 2021, the entertainment segment made $28 billion.
In profit, not revenue.
That's in profit, yeah. And that $28 billion is divided between, there's a little sliver of Fox here. I'm not even going to count them because that sliver is so marginal. It might come down to like $27.5 billion if we take them out. So Netflix, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Disney, and Comcast. So that's five companies
making $27 billion in profit.
In profit.
You're talking roughly $5 billion per company.
Exactly. And this is like that's it. Like, those are the studio. There's no other, it's not like, oh, that's where 27 billion of the profit comes from, and then the other 27 billion comes from these 15 companies. No,
it's, no,
there is these five fucking companies, man. Like, and that's where it all stems from, in my opinion, is the fact that there's no other like studios out there competing and making, giving writers a place to seek refuge or a place to go, oh, hey, you know what? This like other studio pays way better. We should go do stuff over there. You know, there's none of those conversations. I feel like everyone is being squeezed. And how the hell is it possible for people to be squeezed when there's 27 billion in profit floating around, you know?
It's absolutely insane. And that's yearly profit.
Yeah. And I know that, like, you know, people will say, oh, you know, well, there's a lot of costs for us to cover and, you know, we deserve 27 billion in profit. There's a lot of people involved at these companies making shit run, blah, 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 blah.
I think that's after everyone's paid.
I think they're working on off of content that the writers are creating in a lot of ways. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, that they don't make that money if the writers don't write great scripts that get made into great movies.
Yeah. For me, I think that's really just what it comes down to is that there are too few where everything's reconsolidated at this point, basically. So it's, you know, it's the same problem that, you know, we've had in a lot of different industries in the US, but monopolization more or less is like the issue, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, when, isn't that supposed to be the whole point of the free market that capitalists love so much is it supposed to, the competition is supposed to bring out the best out of everyone and it's supposed to equalize itself.
Right.
Well, guess what? That doesn't happen
when there's no fucking competition.
when you can just buy up your competition because you're already bigger than them.
Yeah.
You just get bigger and bigger. You're like, it's like a snowball going down a mountain where it's, once it's got this momentum, once it's this large,
good luck stopping.
Yeah. You're not going to stop it.
Good. I don't understand. I mean, I don't really understand why no one's come in and like broken it up yet. Like, does the government just not have that power, or are they?
No, of course they have that power.
Yeah, it's a little bit it's baffling to me.
It's because of lobbyists.
Yeah,
I mean, it's because corporations or corporate interests control our politicians, because we have this middleman where, you know, a special interest paying the government would be bribery, but a special interest paying a lobbyist to convince the government of something, that's okay. And it's like, well, what do you think the lobbyists are doing?
Yeah,
they're paying the politicians.
So what do you think? I know that this is a, you know, it's a wild question, but what do you think is going to happen with this strike? I know that there's obviously a lot of information that we aren't privy to, and we don't really know what's happening behind the scenes, but just, you know, off top, and I can say what I think is going to happen to give you some time to gather your thoughts.
I'm
not very confident personally.
Yeah. I don't know. We had a, one of our producer friends was in here earlier, and his opinion was that this wasn't going to work out too well for the writers. Because right now, I think the studios can kind of just outlast them. You know, they can, for example, I think Netflix just invested a lot of money in like Korean series or films.
Right.
And they've already said that they have like up to 2 years of unreleased content that they can just coast on in the meantime. Now, how much do I believe that? How much of it is a bluff? It's hard to say. Netflix makes a lot of stuff, but they also cancel a lot of
bad stuff.
Exactly. And it's like, well, sure, you have stuff, but is any of it going to be a hit? Is it, you know, you already are willing to cancel shit, you know, at the drop of a hat. So are you just going to...
I think a lot of what's going to basically, in my opinion, determine how successful this is cross guild solidarity.
100%.
I think if SAG can align with WGA, and if the Directors Guild can align and they can really grind things to a halt and squeeze the studios, then things will happen. But I don't think on their own any of these. I think SAG on their own could actually, like, you know, put pressure on, but I think on their own, a lot of these different, like WGA, IATSE, honestly, as well, I think on their own, it's really, really difficult to compete against giant studios that have a ton of money and a ton of resources when the jobs that you're fighting for are, frankly, like I've said it before, jobs that others will do for cheap or free because they're in such high demand. Like, people really want to write things.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, what's the quality of that writing going to be?
Yeah,
it's yet to be seen.
Right.
That's exactly what I was telling our friend earlier, is I think the writer's only real chance is, I believe that the Directors Guild has, right now they have like a non-strike clause or something along those lines, that it expires at the end of June. So the writers are, at the very least, I think we're going to see this strike last until the end of June, at the absolute earliest. And then I believe that the Screen Actors Guild has something similar expiring sometime this summer.
So it's going to be, it will be the summer of sizzle, or whatever we were calling.
Yeah, the summer of sizzle. It is
going to sizzle.
It's the content might, there might be no content, so you might have to listen to Sizzle Reel. You might not have an alternative.
And I was saying this earlier, like, for me, and I know that, like, you know, I'm often guilty of thinking the way that I consume media is the way that everyone does, which is just not true.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't really watch Netflix or Paramount or Warner Brothers or Disney or Comcast. So, like, to me, I hate to say it, but it's like, I'm not even going to notice the impact of this. I wouldn't notice it if I didn't work in the industry and read about this shit every day. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think you probably watch more of those things than you realize. I mean, you stream a decent amount of Apple TV Plus shows, don't you? Right.
I mean, I like them, but I don't really watch them. You know, I think that they're cool, and like,
you can take it or leave it, basically.
Right.
But you still watch them.
Sure,
you know.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
So, I think you do consume a little bit more than maybe you realize.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider just about any movie or series that you watch is probably made by these five or six studios.
True. Yeah. We'll see what happens with it. I'm not confident, and I'm a little bit frightened, but I think, you know, it would be cool if, like, one of these big studios decided, like, hey, we're going to go rogue and we ourselves will meet the WGA on their demands. And that way, maybe they have a monopoly on the Writers Guild and they go, hey, everything we produce is WGA stuff.
I could certainly see something like someone like Apple doing that, because they're worth, you know, $3 trillion. Yeah. That's nothing to them.
Yeah.
I think that would be super interesting. I don't know if we'll be lucky enough to see it happen that way. I think this is going to be a long strike. I think, and you know, especially with the way that just the world has been, the economy over the last few years, and we've seen the corporate greed and just squeezing out every last bit of money they can out of the common folk, I think that they're going to have a lot of support in general. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the kind of strike that might be bigger than just Hollywood, you know?
Yeah.
This could be something that inspires additional unions to do the same thing,
and just people to kind of think about what's happening in their industries.
Yeah,
you know. So there you go, WGA contract 2023.org. if you want more resources, go there. You can find everything. Definitely don't use us as the main source of information.
No,
we just kind of bullshit. But you know what, I said at the beginning that was going to be a heavy segment, and it was pretty deep. I mean, that's a pretty, like, robust.
It was a struggle to get through a little bit at moments. It's very dense language, and it's a lot of Hollywood terms, and a lot of legalese. It's kind of difficult to understand at first and wrap your head around. So we were kind of just working through it as we went.
I mean, you know, a few weeks ago we did some stupid segment where it was Chris versus David Lynch, and it was you just like arguing with David Lynch and he didn't exist or something, right? Or we did Trope Creep Invitational Bracket Madness, or we've done the Trend Forecast with Luis. But But today we really decided to do some real hard hitting journalism.
That's when we start to flounder, is when we do the real shit.
Yeah.
When it's just us fucking around.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. Well, yeah. Like I said, WGAcontract2023.org. Go check it out. Find your resources and support them.
Yeah, hopefully everyone just learned something, and we certainly learned something last week.
That's right. What we learned
last week.
So last week I learned that in Sweden, Mel Brooks's movies are almost entirely titled "Springtime for Blank." So in Sweden, the producers.
Wow, very topical. The producers,
yeah. The producers was released. The literal translation was "Springtime for Hitler," and because it was a very successful movie in Sweden, they just kind of continued that theme as a recognition thing.
Yeah.
So some of his other movies in Sweden, the 12 Chairs is called "Springtime for Mother-in-Law." Blazing Saddles is called "Springtime for the Sheriff." Young Frankenstein is called "Springtime for Frankenstein." Silent Movie is "Springtime for the Silent Movies." Spaceballs is "Springtime for Space."
I feel like, how do you think Mel Brooks feels about
History
that?
Of the World Part 1 is "Springtime for World History."
Like, I feel like Mel Brooks is probably hilarious. Like, this is hilarious. Yeah.
I think it's fantastic.
That's fucking amazing.
That's incredible.
"Springtime for Space." I learned about the giant video walls behind news broadcasts. So,
yeah,
you know how they, instead of putting just green or blue behind like the news broadcasters, I mean, they'll do like a screen, right, for the weather and shit. But behind the actual desk, the anchor desk, they have these giant video panels. They're like LED, no, LCD, something, some sort of gigantic video panel, right? And they're like literally the size of a whole entire wall.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
They have tons of these panels that kind of wrap around. So from any angle, they're back there and they have like a seamless kind of video that plays across them. But these walls are giant panels that lock into one another.
Yes.
So they not only have the panels that are there behind them, but they also have extra panels in case a panel goes out or something goes wrong. But in order to make sure that the panels age at the same rate and the luminance stays the same, when they turn on the panels for the actual broadcast, they also turn on the spare panels and run things on them to make sure that if something was to go wrong and they swap one in, they don't have like a crazy brightness difference.
That's
so they make sure to keep all the panels on whenever, like at the same time, you know, so that way they're
aging
at the same rate. Yeah. Pretty cool stuff. All right, Chris, where can the people find us?
Oh, we are at Scissoreel Gang on Twitter and Instagram. We are scissoreelgang@gmail.com. Send us an email. We are scissoreelgangthewebsite.com. Maybe you'll find a GoFundMe on there.
Yeah.
And of course, we have the Scissoreel Gold Line.
That's right.
That is 332-333-4361.
Call in, text in, and let us know what you think of the WGA strike. Let us know what we messed up. And let us know how strikes have impacted your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think everyone's striking these days, you know?
Yeah. Bowling turkeys.
As a matter of fact, I'm actually about to strike Scissoreel for one solid week.
Wow.
But I'll see you next week.
All right.
Bye.
Shishkin Productions Podcast.